Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 122 of Real Blend, a podcast that's recorded entirely in the cockpit of an airplane. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and man, oh man, do we have a show for you guys this week. Hollywood's release calendar is shifting an awful lot yet again. DC has announced a fan event, a virtual fan event that will be taking place in August, and we have a lot of details to share with you guys about it. And our special guest this week, in addition to the David Koepp bonus episode that we hope you guys downloaded and enjoyed, we are going to be joined by Andrew Patterson, who is the director of that awesome alien invasion. I was going to call it Alien Invasion, but I guess that's not accurate. The Vast of Night, a film that we were talking about on previous episodes, and hopefully you guys got a chance to check it out on Amazon Prime. And then we got into some great details with him about the making of that. And when I say we, I mean our co-hosts in Real Blendomness, starting with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
Hi, buddy. I like that. Co-host of Real Blendedness.
Real Blendedness.
Awesome. Well done.
And in the third chair, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Fellas, good to see you as always. Honored to be talking movies with you guys today.
Right before we started talking movies, we were discussing whether we should all get a tattoo.
Yes.
A Real Blend tattoo of some sort, but not just the logo, like all of our faces.
Everyone's I'm thinking like a Mount Rushmore, and then like just replace, you know, we always talk about like who would be on our Mount Rushmores. What if we were on our Mount Rushmores?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of poetic. I kind of like the way that plays out. Plugs, a reminder, we have a community page over on Facebook. There's always very fun conversations going on between the Blender family. So head over there and join us if you haven't yet. We are posting all of these episodes to Cinema Blend's YouTube page. So if you're watching us right now, hello, hi, how are you guys doing? And of course, you can get the show wherever podcasts are available. Announcement. I kind of teased this at the end of last week's show, but we have a merch store coming very, very soon.
What? Tell me again,
yes.
Sean.
Gabe has put a ton of effort into this merch store, and it's going to be coming early next week. So keep your eyes peeled on our social media and then tune in. And really, it's a response to, first off, everybody who participated in the Real Blend charitable initiative to get that T-shirt, you guys were all incredible. And we love everybody who grabbed a shirt. And thank you so much for doing a really good thing, not just for the show, but for the Will Rogers Pioneers Foundation, helping theater employees. But when that campaign ended, we got a ton of great responses from people on social media and people emailing us saying, hey, I missed the shirt. Is there a chance for me to get it? And it really kicked us in the ass and told us we need to get going on that merchandise store. So sooner or later, you guys will be able to have some Real Blend merch that you guys can sport. And we would be really, really happy that you guys are doing it to support the show. Yes, Kevin.
Sean, I was just curious if there's any way that I could put a bid out there to get Real Blend toilet paper made so we could do like a bathroom blend, kind of like coincide those two bits together. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Gabe, is that possible? You're familiar with the store and the merch?
I don't think there's a toilet paper option. Sorry.
All right.
So yet again, your bathroom blend plans are foiled.
You hear that? That's the sound of dreams being crushed.
Yeah, yes. Man. Come on.
I will say, without getting into too many details, because we can't reveal from where this conversation came. Oh. But yesterday we did have a conversation in which we all agreed upon a certain context in which we would do bathroom blend.
Bathroom blend has moved forward.
I don't want to say too much. But it's the first time I've ever said
baby steps.
Okay, I would participate under those circumstances.
Yeah, because Kevin and I have been on board.
Yeah.
Oh,
you hear that, kids? That's what they call a tease in the TV business.
We made genuine headway yesterday. Bathroom blend is back in the saddle. We are on the way. It's happening eventually.
Back on the toilet seat. We have a weekly poll.
I'm going to lose it this week. I can
only tell. In honor of Spike Lee's amazing film, Defy Bloods, which is on Netflix, and I did see a lot of blenders going to social media and commenting about it, we decided to dedicate last week's social media poll to Spike Lee. And we basically asked you guys, what is Spike Lee's second best film? Assuming, which I kind of thought everybody would, that Do the Right Thing is his best film. I hate doing that too. When someone, their first film, or actually that's not his first, it's his second, but when a really early film is dubbed their best, because it creates such a high bar that it's almost not fair for them to be able to cross. But then, so we added Malcolm X as a choice. Malcolm X, The 25th Hour, Black Klansman, which is his most recent one before Defy Bloods, and then we gave you Other in case people wanted to throw out some other opportunities. So I will throw it to Jake Hamilton to tell me which of Malcolm X, The 25th Hour, Black Klansman, or Other do you think won the poll?
I want it to be 25th Hour because that's what I genuinely believe it is. Right. I think, unfortunately, not enough people have seen 25th Hour, which I think is going to be working against it because of the massive amount of popularity that came with Black Klansman and the overall goodwill toward that movie.
Best picture nominee.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Black Klansman just because it's recent in everyone's mind. I'd argue it's one of his most accessible films. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I feel like just not enough people have seen 25th Hour, and I think far more people lie about having seen Malcolm X and have actually seen it.
Black Klansman dominated with 53.9% of the votes, and Malcolm X came in second with 28.7%. 25th Hour only got 10%. And I saw this on social media. Somebody tweeted this, that they went back to revisit 25th Hour, and I guess it never got a Blu-ray release, or it's not nearly as widely available as a bunch of other Spike Lee films are, and I wonder why. I don't know what studio it's on, like
Apple TV. I rented it.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Because I went and back through my collection too to see if I had it. And I don't think I do.
It's got a really horrible DVD cover. Like it was like the poster itself was this very cool, mostly red poster with Edward Norton in the distance walking his dog, and the DVD cover is his giant ass head covering the entire screen.
That's awful.
And that's also the first movie Isaiah Whitlock Jr. ever said the word she.
Yeah, I watched that clip today. That was great.
That's the, because I guess a lot of people know it from The Wire, but that became obviously he did it in 25th Hour and he did it in Defy Bloods, but I actually did not realize how many times he said it in The Wire. Someone sent me a montage today of him just dropping it. How did it not become a bit? It seems like a bit when you watch it in a montage, but I guess in the show it probably made more sense.
It feels a little bit like a bit by the end of him doing it, because then he just sort of made them longer and longer. Right. So I think the last time he did it was legitimately a full minute long where he's just holding it.
It's funny because he does it in Defy Bloods, and it's a joke thing that's become more, but I thought one of the things I found interesting was the cast was saying it actually helped with the camaraderie of the soldiers, so it actually made sense. But he works that into every movie. Spike Lee, I guess it was the first time it ever happened on 25th Hour, but I didn't realize that 25th Hour and The Wire started in the same year. So what I was trying to figure out was, I guess someone must have seen, or he must have filmed 25th Hour, and then when he went to shoot The Wire, maybe told them about the bit he was doing.
How long until The Wire? Because I'm 3-4 episodes in and he hasn't done it yet. I keep waiting for it and he hasn't done it. Maybe it's after it's come out that it becomes a Wire thing, but maybe it took a little while.
But today, for example, I aired that interview on my show, Fox 5 in DC, and everybody was like, oh, that's from The Wire. And for me, it's always
how
been
did
a Spike
you air
Lee.
That without explaining to people what it is?
What I did was I didn't air that part of the interview. I pushed people to the YouTube channel in Fox 5 DC so they could find that clip. But I explained it on the air. And then my producer got in my ear. And he was like, you're talking about she, aren't you? I'm like, yes, I am. And so that was that. But that honestly is one of the greatest bits. But it's in all of his movies. But Spike Lee, 25th Hour is where he first started it. So
we jumped to this is our interview segment for the week. And we wanted to get Andrew Patterson on the show because Vast of Night's one of those films that just sort of stuck with us. It's a really fun experiment in taking a film back to the 1950s, doing what felt almost like a radio play with a small amount of characters, them sort of chasing after a mysterious sound, a UFO sound kind of, and people calling in to an old fashioned radio station to give away stories about what the sound might mean. It really intrigued us. And
physicality of her plugging those phones in was so cool. Insane. I loved watching her switch the phone jacks. That was so cool.
So we reached out to Andrew Patterson, and he wasn't doing a ton of press for that movie ahead of time. You guys got the two actors when they did press day for it, but not the director. And one of the funniest things that happened to us is whenever we ask for time, we kind of ask for a half an hour. Sometimes we have to cut it back to like 20 minutes or so, depending on how a press day is going. And they actually got back to us and they were like, Andrew actually prefers to go longer. So can you guys do 45 minutes? And we were like, that's the greatest thing we could ever hear. We love hearing that. So this is our interview with Andrew Patterson, where he dives into the making of and then the impact of The Vast of Night and how it's helping him out with his career moving forward. I hope you guys enjoy.
Andrew, seriously, first of all, thank you for joining us on Real Blend. We all in this podcast love this movie. And we wouldn't say it if we didn't do, because we do a lot of interviews for movies that we don't necessarily love. And then we just kind of just go with the interview. So seriously, the movie is incredible. Thank you so much for your time. I want to jump into sort of this battle that I've been having with myself in terms of how I talk about this movie with my audience. Because it's an easy hook to just say, oh, guys, it's an alien movie and you have to watch it. But I really do feel like that is just a giant disservice, because it is so much more than that. I'm curious on your end. When you're pitching it to someone, or even when you're talking to your friends and family about this movie that you're making, how far down into your description of the film do you get before you use the word alien?
Oh my gosh, that's a question I've never been asked. I don't know that I ever did.
Interesting.
I always said it was a, because you know, there was a nice 2 or 3 years from the time that I shot it to the time that really anyone saw it. And so people would want to know, people that I was friends with and grew up with that knew, or people that worked on the film, or people that they would want to know, what's it like? What did you make? What was your movie about? And I would always say it's a thriller set in the 1950s, or a Twilight Zone type thriller set in the 1950s. And then if they would usually go, huh? Oh, interesting. I kind of like that. I mean, I like Twilight Zone, and that would usually be where I would leave it. I'm not one to really go sell my work or like explain in depth what I do and what I'm trying to do. I just hope that when the movie's done one day, you'll watch it and go down. So I don't know if I ever have said aliens unless it was in a production meeting or pre-production meeting or something like that.
Interesting.
That's pretty awesome. I am particularly enamored with the 50s as a genre. I love stories told in that time frame. There's something about that period. It has an innocence to it. The look to it, it has a newness to it that I'm attracted to. When I see a movie shot during that period, I get lost in the thought process of how a filmmaker secures the resources to stage it. Like, how do you even go about finding enough cars that look camera ready? How do you decorate the gym, dress the gym to look like an authentic 50s high school gym? And even just down to like the equipment that you need for Faye's phone console or Everett's radio booth. All of these things are challenges where you can write it on the page, but having to bring it to life, I would assume, is far more difficult than people would imagine.
Okay, well, I have a question. Have you guys ever been to like the middle of America, like Texas, Oklahoma?
I'm from Texas. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. So all you got to do is walk into an antique store and that stuff is sitting around.
No
kidding.
Like
a lot of the stuff, you'd be shocked how much the middle of America. And by the way, there aren't any prop houses out here in the middle of Oklahoma, like Oklahoma, Texas. You just go and you go looking. And so I kind of grew up around old stuff. Like it was not weird to just, you know, have a friend that had a jukebox that was from the 40s or the 50s, or have like, you know, have people that drive older cars than they should, or have a handful of classic cars, just sort of because that was their hobby that they were interested in. And so to answer your question, when we were developing the script, the try to make it tight enough that the resources that were needed be found. So so in our case, we looked at this and we knew that we had three acts, right? We knew we needed to create a switchboard room, and we knew we needed to create a radio station, and we knew we needed to outfit or at least set dress a living room to look like it was in the 50s. And that felt digestible, what I just described there. That felt like we could bite that off and make that happen. Okay, forget the gym, forget the outside, forget the streets and the big thing, the really hard things. We knew that we could probably, what I just described there, those three things ended up being about, we shot all three of those locations in just 3 days of our shoot. And wow. And that's 65 pages of the movie, which meant that the rest of the shoot could kind of be geared towards the more complicated stuff, like the things that deal with cars and the things that deal with lots of extras, or one that nobody thinks of, which is just lighting giant swaths of land, right? Like that one, that one alone, if you've never done it before, will eat your lunch. So we, without having anybody on the movie producer wise or anything, we, before we even really had a, you know, a decent sized budget, we were able to procure the switchboards. We were able to build the radio station. And we did this for, you know, pennies on the dollar, a few thousand dollars. And I say this so that indie filmmakers out there can understand that, like, we didn't just go to somebody and then say, solve our problems, build a radio station for us, and then we get a big bill, you know, that's $10,000. We went and found the stuff. We went and eBayed the turntables that are in the radio station. I went to a guy that collects old audio equipment, and he built the radio station for me. In fact, he's one of the guys that wrote the score on the movie, Eric Alexander. So this is how thrifty we had to be. Then you get to something like the cars, which start to be bigger resources. And literally what we would do is if we saw an old car sitting in somebody's driveway or flying down the road within 100 miles of our location in Texas, we would go after them. we would flag them down at a stoplight. No kidding. And we would say, can we get your number and name? You don't have to stop for us, but we have a movie and we'd love to use your car. And then a lot of times people in that area of the world haven't ever done anything that felt like this, like felt like a movie that was a creative opportunity. And so that's how we got a lot of cars. And we actually, I think on our largest night, we only got 16. And so we had to be we had to play Tetris with our cars in the parking lot to make sure that it looked like there were more. And then you get to something like the gym, and that's actually the anchor location for the movie. That's why we shot the movie in Whitney, Texas, is because that gym by and large looked like it does in the movie. We repainted a few things. We did sand down the basketball court so that it didn't have volleyball lines and 3-point lines and things that would make it anachronistic. And that was a bigger expense than I wanted, but you know, it was important to me. And so after that, you know, we had this gym, this kind of hero location that if it did its job in the first 5 minutes of the movie, you would think you were in the 50s and you would never start looking hard for the things that maybe would be tells. It would be giveaways that we were not.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that is amazing. And it's funny too, because I would have sworn that you guys had dozens and dozens and dozens of cars all at one time. So it's a testament to how you guys shot that. Speaking of the 50s, one of the things I really loved about this movie, and I feel like it's really been more relevant in the last 10 days than even when I saw it, is this idea of amplifying voices that weren't listened to. And it's easy to say initially, like, okay, like the voices above, but specifically the two voices in the film that we hear from, one being a black man, the other an older woman. People in the 50s who were not listened to at that time. You know, right now we're really in this age of really, you know, talk less and listen more. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that theme of amplifying voices that just weren't listened to in the 1950s.
Oh, I mean, I love that question. So we wrote the script this time 5 years ago. Okay, so that tells you how you can't know that your movie is going to drop in the middle of probably, at least in our lifetimes, the most important window of time about social injustice and so on. So I can't take credit for that. I can say that I do care deeply about voices that aren't heard. And I always wanted to tell my movies and tell the story from the point of view of people that maybe you don't get to hear from and see and listen to very often. And it started by knowing that I wanted a female teenager to be the protagonist, which was not maybe what you would choose to make a film that is a Twilight Zone thriller, paranormal, and close encounter type of movie about. You just that alone, just deciding to make it about a young nerdy girl who ends up kind of being like having her own character engine, I guess, or impetus was a big decision to let go. Okay, cool. We're gonna let you think the movie's about the radio jock guy, and then we're gonna steal that away from him and let this be about her, right? And then it became clear that I haven't written anything. I've never written a script or made a movie that didn't have a very strong minority character or lead. And I loved the idea that you had somebody who was willing to talk, but the people of his generation wouldn't have cared to listen yet. And that this is the character of Billy. And so when we get to him, he basically has these fresh ears for the first time in, you know, a decade or two decades. And they're listening because maybe the people that are their parents' age weren't and wouldn't. And then you have the last act with Mabel. And I keep finding that everything I write, I somehow always write an old woman into it. I'm doing it right now at the one I'm writing. And I don't know why. I feel like they have so much to impart and so much to tell us. And I wanted Mabel to feel like somebody that was clear-eyed and once again hadn't been listened to. And so I'm glad you picked up on those themes. I'm even more glad that they've landed in a window of time when people maybe are more receptive to that kind of storytelling and those kinds of characters.
Andrew, I was reading a great point in an interview that you gave about this movie, where how difficult it was for you to land a DP that really fit what you wanted to accomplish, and how you had zeroed in on that as a realm that you desperately wanted to get right. But you went through a lot of rejections from what you said, from a ton of people who you wanted to work with. And we do have a number of sort of budding filmmakers, people who are really interested in the filmmaking process. And I think it's important for them to hear from you how much rejection is such a huge part of this process and how important it is to fight for a component of your film that you know, is going to make or break the project.
Yeah, I feel like if I can be of any service to anybody out there trying to make a movie, it's to let them know that you have to keep pushing forward when nobody wants to help you. And this was consistent for months and months when we were making the movie that, you know, I would call a casting director. I had two casting directors that said they would love to help. And then that was it. They wouldn't email me back. And I'd send them the script, and then they would say, I wouldn't get an email back. I have two unreturned emails from casting directors where I described this exact movie, where I described it's about the switchboard operator and radio station. Yeah. Yeah. And they didn't, they after they read that breakdown, they never emailed me back. I had dozens of people that wouldn't let me talk to a DP or wouldn't let me meet with a DP or a cinematographer. And I just kind of got to the point where it was like, well, I'm going to make this movie no matter what. Mm-hmm. So it got to be daily. You just kind of get tough skin. You just get to the point where you go, okay, well, this person doesn't want to cast movie, then someone else will. This mm-hmm. person doesn't want to DP my movie or even move the offer onto their client, you know, an agent who wouldn't even move that happened a lot. And we point where, you know, we knew we were going to make the movie no matter what, but the rejection is something that you have to understand is part of you getting to where you are finding creative solutions for everything. Mm-hmm. If everything just drops in your lap, I don't even know that I would want to see a movie where everything just dropped in the director's lap or the producer's lap or the creative team's lap. Because, and this is something I talk to high level producers about that have produced, you know, franchise movies that are as big as anything that's happened this century. And they still say it doesn't matter if you have $150 million, you still have to be creative, even at that mm-hmm. level, and so on. So I would just say take the rejection and figure out a way to be creative with it.
I love that. Andrew, I want to talk about, I guess what I'm referring to is anti-inspirations, because I remember reading an interview with Spielberg when War of the Worlds came out, I don't know, what was it, like 15 years ago? And he talked, and people were asking him about, like, different alien movies that inspired him, and in fact, he said, well, let me tell you what, here are all the things I hate that people put in alien movies, things I'm sick of seeing the White House blow up, and I'm sick of seeing this, and he sort of made the opposite on that. I'm curious, you know, obviously we talked about how this movie is so much more than an alien movie, but are there tropes from that genre that you absolutely wanted to steer clear of, that you're just sick of seeing?
That's a great question. I would have to think back, because, you know, they were things that we avoided in the script, you know, 5 years ago now when we were writing it. I can tell you this. I didn't want to see a romance. I didn't want to see something bud in a 90 minute real time movie that would seem preposterous by any stretch of the imagination. I can tell you that I didn't want to see squabbling amongst an older generation and a younger generation. Like, okay. I didn't want to see some townsperson that was a mayor or a, you know, and a town hall getting called in the middle of the movie where some people believe and some people don't believe. And it's this squabbling. I don't like squabbling and fighting in movies anyway. I just think that that's a trope that tends to feel like when you're writing it, it's interesting. But it's just sort of like noise and cats fighting on screen when it happens. So I avoided that. I can tell you that we wanted it to be the opposite of the tradition of just sort of having a lot of fucking scenes like that. I think if we've learned anything from a movie like Gravity or 1917 or any number of these movies where not as much happens over the course of 2 hours, it's not about cutting and having 200 scenes in your movie or having really quick scenes or having 30 seconds here and 10 minutes here and bouncing around with different characters. So we were avoiding that. Not to say that that doesn't work. I think that there's, for crying out loud, you can look at movies like Zero Dark Thirty or anything that feels like that just has an immense amount of scenes and activity and momentum, and I'm just as big a fan of that as I am the films that don't need that. And so we knew we were going to make a movie that was mainly three scenes. That was because we were trying to shoot for a play, and so the anti-inspiration would be watching movies that had like 20 characters and you were bouncing around between all these narratives and they didn't necessarily seem to serve the story so much as they just seemed to serve short attention spans.
Andrew, we have to talk about your sound. It's a character. It has to be a character in and of itself. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the process of creating it. Also, if there were some that you heard that you rejected for various reasons. And I specifically kind of want to know if you let Sierra hear it before she had to interact with it for the first time on camera.
Okay, I'll answer that right now, and then I'll go through this, because no, she was in a room in September of 2016, and we didn't have the first sound until a year later, September 2017. And so she's reacting to nothing. And just being Sierra McCormick, which okay. is a brilliant, she was 18 at the time, just a brilliant, very experienced young actress. And I would get into her head a little bit, you know. I would just say something like, so you're looking at the radio and this is going to be the thing that leads you down the rabbit hole. And then I would see what she would do with that. Okay. I would look at her, I would say, when you hear this sound, the universe just got a lot bigger. And she would turn that into her response. Then we get to a year later, and I have two wonderful sound designers working on the movie. David Rosenblatt did the lion's share of it, and then Johnny Marshall did a lot of the sniping. And Johnny is the sound designer on movies like Upstream Color and Ghost Story and anything that David Lowery's done lately. Old Man of the Gun. So I got kind of an out of my weight class sound designer.
Texas film community, right? That's everybody in that area. Sure, of course.
Yeah, that's it. So Johnny is like, Johnny's everyone's first call if you're making a movie in Texas or whatever. And I think I met with him in November of 2016 after we'd finished shooting the movie. And he was like booked until June or something of the next year. I mean, it was like that far out. Right. And that was fine because I needed my VFX to have some time to bake and all that and to edit the movie. So the first pass of the sound was a little, it was more like, it sounded more home appliance-esque, like a little bit more like a Dust Devil or maybe a jet engine at a distance.
Okay.
And it's still under it. Like, we didn't lose that. We just turned it into something that wasn't the primary thing because I needed the sound. I had parameters for what I wanted. My number one parameter is I wanted it to sound new in cinema. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to feel like you'd heard a piece of it somewhere in a Star Wars movie or an old episode of Twilight Zone or something. I wanted it to feel like when it was all said and done, this is a new sound. And the second is I didn't want it to be threatening at all. I needed it to sound like it was not coming from anything that was here to like crawl into your brain and like take control of your, you know, body and that. I mean, it just needed to be kind of mesmerizing. And of course, those are really vague when you say that. That doesn't exactly like give someone a roadmap go this way. And when you get there, it's going to look like this. That was basically my instructions. And so the first pass I wasn't huge on. And we started to pull it back. And I made sure that I told them I wanted something that sounded like maybe there were some very slight throat glottal noises in it. Like mm-hmm. I actually, this is a reference I think maybe your people will get. I really always thought it was really beautiful in the first Lord of the Rings film when Gandalf talks to a moth that lands with him. And if you hear that and then you hear our sound, you can kind of see how we leaned a little bit towards that.
I just rewatched that movie. That's so cool that you said that. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I'm sure that was just Ian McKellen making that up on site, you know, like just being brilliant like he is. So that was a little bit of where we came from on the sound. And that's kind of how we got to where it is today.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
That's awesome. Andrew, I'm going to ask my next question carefully because I'm one of the people, I don't like to know the answers to things. I like, kind of just wondering, and I don't want to know at the end of Inception if the totem falls over. I don't want to know if like the Joker is imagining everything. I'd rather get into an argument with someone about it, which we do on this podcast a lot. But what I don't want is a filmmaker to come out and say, here's the definitive answer, because I feel like that kind of ruins it. That being said, I am always curious as to whether or not the filmmaker knows the answer and just doesn't want to tell us. So I'm curious, there are some unanswered questions, specifically with the ending in terms of like what happens. I had the chance to chat with Jake and Sierra, and I put that interview on my YouTube channel. And even within the comment section, people are debating and arguing and talking about what happened. So without answering as to what happens at the end and then beyond when we cut to black, like, do you know definitively in your mind, or do you not care?
I do know. And the thing is, I would never give you my take anyway. I'm very big on ambiguity in storytelling. And I believe it's actually, I love what ifs. I love what ifs. I think they are the engine of so many wonderful conversations and debates. And, you know, I'm very much that way about everything. And so I know what I wrote. I know what the thinking was behind everything that concludes the film. I know the science and the physics that we were aiming towards with all of it. And I would say that hopefully everybody finds their own answer. And my wife has a completely different take than I do. And she has a very, you know, and a lot of people, a lot of my friends that listen to me talk or ask me about the film, they want an answer. And I'm like, are you sure? And if I give it to them, you know, everyone has a different point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I love for people to come to their own conclusion.
Have you heard of any theories where someone says, like, this is what I think happens, and you just pause and go, like, that's stupid. No, that's not it.
No, I don't. I don't like to take away people's joy of the possibility that they've arrived at. I think it's my co-writer on the film, Craig Sanger, is a like huge conspiracy theory kind of fan and guy. And when we were writing this movie, actually, I think when we were scouting it, we ran through, you know, a lot of different things that he was digging up at the time about the JFK assassination. And I think part of the reason that things like that stay interesting forever is because they can't be answered. And so far be it from me to jump in and put a definitive take on something.
That's cool.
We are obviously audience members who watch a ton of film. And, you know, not that we're ahead of a film a lot of times, but when we start to settle into what the story is going to be and the beats start to reveal themselves, I think we have a lot of fun internally just thinking like, okay, but how far are we going to go with the story? How much is going to get shown? How deep down the rabbit hole are we going to go? We can talk spoilers because the film's been out for a little while. I will put up a spoiler warning for anybody here. You know, we will get into a couple of details. You do take the time to design a ship. You do show a ship. I'm curious if any point in the process, did you allow yourselves to come up with a design for what your aliens might have looked like?
Okay. No, because, I mean, it was something that I never, like, all the way back to the original screenplay. I mean, there was some thoughts, and they were only ever thoughts.
Okay.
That you would see, like, that somewhere in a field, Faye would walk out there with her baby sister, and it was always alone. It wasn't created yet. So that tells you how early in this thought was.
Wow.
There were some thoughts that there would have been a ship, like a smaller one, in a field or in a forest, and she walked onto it and just sort of looked around and had this like experience. And that might have been a very unique thing, but I kind of felt like I'd seen that before. I feel like I never saw it, but I feel like maybe that's kind of how Predator 2 ended. Or I'm sorry, what's the one? Is there a Danny Glover?
That's Predator 2.
Sorry, guys. I'm not that big. I'm a big fan of that world, but I feel like he ends up on a ship and sees alien heads on it, right?
Isn't that
kind of like,
correct.
So yes. I felt like that's what I was stealing when I thought of that. Was like this thing was like, oh, I'm just doing Predator 2 at this point. And so I kind of imagined there was a scene where she walked on a ship, but she didn't ever see anything. She didn't see an alien, so to speak. And right. So that was the closest I would have gotten to it, not just being what it ended up being in the movie, which is a scout ship and a mothership, and being the way that we finished it. But no, we didn't. I didn't ever think that this movie would ever make it as far as it did. Like, I really, I mean, this was, if you look at some of the bold choices in this movie, I didn't think for a fucking second that there would be like people actually watching this thing all the way through. Now, I thought I made a good film, but I thought it would maybe come in 10 or 15 or 20 years. Okay. I did not think that it would drop on Amazon and kind of experience that it's sort of turning out to be. The last thing I was ever thinking was, oh, people might enjoy seeing some kind of life form. And I wouldn't have felt comfortable stretching our budget to that point. I think we would have like really maybe shot ourselves in the foot trying to do something that was a mixture of like a Muppet and a CGI thing, you know, that just would have like probably really sucked.
Well, to that end, then, can you just talk a little bit about the reaction to the reception? Because we talk a lot about, you know, with theatrical releases, you have the attention of the audience, you know, you get a marketing run up. And we're in a brave new world kind of now with streaming and even with all of the options. You know, for a while it was just Netflix, but now it's Disney Plus and HBO Max and Amazon Prime. And too many films of all different types of qualities get released and don't find their audience. this one has really caught on. You know, the buzz surrounding this has been so strong, and I can't tell you just how many casual people during a quarantine have come up to me and said, hey, did you check out Vast of Night? And so please tell me just your reaction to being able to cut through the zeitgeist with this film, and if it's then, you know, sort of changed your ability to follow up on the film. Is it giving you a little bit more freedom and opportunity?
Okay. First of all, I'm not in, I stay off of social media and generally stay away from the reactions and the internet at large for my own creative sanity. And so if it's going well and people are excited about it, that's fantastic. I only know that from some of my publicity team and my wife occasionally telling me it's going well. So I don't want to say I'm the last one there, but let me put it this way. If I choose to lean into that and start digging around and finding out all this stuff, it's very distracting to my creative process. And I think that the best thing I can do is try to put my head down and write something new that hopefully people that liked what I did here will like the next one even more. And so the fact that it's becoming or has become at least, you know, as you put it, cut through the zeitgeist, I think that's what you would dream. Like, if you could, like, write out your own dream ending, that's what you would want. Like, I never thought that when I made a movie that has scenes where you cut to black long monologues by characters, I thought I would get a festival run and an agent and maybe somebody would pay for my next movie. That was like, that was all. I didn't think we'd get a distribution deal. I didn't think we'd get, and then to get to a place like Amazon where the marketing team just very much fell in love with the movie and turned it into a very important title of theirs is something that you can't pay for people's passions. Like, you either have it or you don't. And they got very serious about it. And then you can't time something out like a pandemic or anything like that. And so we kind of cut through the wheat. Like, we would not have gotten the kind of eyes on it if this had been a normal month of May. And I'm aware of that too. So I'm very grateful. But at the same time, I'm aware that it was kind of a fluke in a sense. I always thought we had a movie that could become like a Dazed and Confused or a Reservoir Dogs or something like that, that nobody really saw when it dropped. And then it became big, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 years later. That's what I always thought we had.
Is there a dream festival you would have loved to have taken to?
Well, I mean, you know, if you've done any poking around, we got rejected by a whole year of festivals. We got, starting in January with Sundance all the way through the end of the year of 2018, we got rejected by all of them. And so I can't say that I'm disappointed in what happened with the movie, because it means that I'll maybe get to go to a festival with another movie later and get to experience that at that point. So I'm very happy that it came out at Slamdance and that it got embraced. And then it sort of snowballed its way up to, you know, something as big as Toronto, where even there we cut through sort of the thing. And then to answer your question about has it changed my opportunities, it has and it hasn't. The way that it has changed my opportunities is it's gotten me into meetings with probably people that I wouldn't have otherwise, you know, certain studios and whatnot, which is lovely. But it hasn't changed it in the fact that I'm not jumping up to really large budget movies right out of the gate. So that's, I probably had the kind of interested investors and creative collaborators for the last year that want to make movies at the level that I'm interested in making it next.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because that was actually my next question. I feel like there is this trend just really within the last 10, 15 years with studios looking at directors who maybe have directed smaller films and then giving them a big franchise. I think it happened with Jurassic World, and it's happened with Star Wars, and it's happened with the Marvel films. Obviously, it sounds like you're already writing your next project, but is that something you have any interest in down the road? Would you love to be handed a franchise movie, or is that something that doesn't interest you at all?
right now, I that would be a very hard thing for me to do, to jump into a franchise, mostly because the things that interest me don't creatively. Don't get me wrong. I sat and watched. I thought the last like two Avengers movies were fantastic, brilliant. Loved them. I love the scale of like a lot of Hollywood stuff. It isn't creatively what I'm interested in doing. My stuff usually looks up and feels a little bit more like, I would say probably early Quentin Tarantino or even. And it's funny to say early Denis Villeneuve, who, you know, made the best movie of the decade, as far as I'm concerned, which was Incendies, which came out in 2010 before he did Prisoners and Sicario and Arrival and so on. And so those movies are super exciting and special to me. And so I can't say that I would never do a franchise or wouldn't take some intellectual property at a much larger budget, but I'm not pursuing it. And it's not that I'm not taking meetings or reading scripts. It's just that the ones I've looked at haven't been enough for me to go that way yet.
I want to jump back to Vast of Night just for a second, because it's in revisiting it to prep for questions for this. It didn't even dawn on me the entire time watching it the first time through, but it's an entirely set at night story. And I'm curious, just from a logistics standpoint, if night shoots are a total bitch.
Yeah. I mean, look, the bottom line is I'm personally kind of obsessed with like things that get in my way. If something is an obstruction, I'm gonna, cool, fine, I'll figure it out. You know, night shoots are tough. So what did we do months before? We had a crew and a grip and an electric team. We ordered extremely powerful lights off of Amazon, and we crawled up water towers and grain silos, and we attached them permanently to these fixtures all over town in Whitney so that we would have light, just so that we could go out and do camera tests. And then whenever our grip and electric guys came in, they would light up the space with a condor or light up, you know, a chunk of a street that didn't have any lights on it. But we would attach, you know, we would go to Home Depot and we would buy clamp lights, like lamps and buckets and zip ties, and we would zip tie them onto things like telephone poles, and we would put the light in a bucket so that it would cut the light in a way that it would shoot down so that we could run our go underneath it without having a shadow, you know, fly through the shot, which is harder than it sounds. Keep like a moving piece of go-kart flying through lights without shadows going everywhere. So night shoots are tough in that you do have to light every lick of it. But if you have time and moxie, you're going to figure it out. And that's what we did. And we crawled up like those lights that hang down the middle of the downtown street. Those are like IKEA lamps that were $15 a piece. And two of my executive producers and I crawled up there with rope, and we hung those in the middle of the street 2 or 3 weeks before production so that we would have light on the street all the time, no matter what, in case our grip and electric guys were cranky one day and didn't want to help us light a scene. So you just get to a point where you have a trapdoor method for everything. And if night shoots, if they're going to be a bitch, then figure out a way to get out in front of that bitch.
Andrew, I'm sorry if this is known. Did you go to film school, or are you backed by an incredible group of friends who were happy to help you?
If you look at the opening title of the movie, it says Amazon Studios, and then it says GED Media. GED stands for whatever that means when you drop out of high school. And so that's it, guys. That was the last thing I did was go to somewhere around 11th grade. And I did 2 or 3 years in college, just to like video kind of like 2000 person junior college sort of level in Oklahoma, and didn't go to film school at all. Never moved out of Oklahoma City even. So everything has just been me and a group of guys that have, you know, believed in what I was doing, even when I was crazy.
Wow. Well, it's funny now that I'm about to ask a guy that didn't go to film school how he knocked off some pretty amazing oners. Because I'd be remiss if I didn't get that in before our time is running out. But Sean and I had the pleasure of speaking with Sam Mendes for 1917. Sorry, wrong movie. Not Spielberg.
Not Spielberg's comedy.
Yeah, yeah. 1917. And he talked about happy accidents, where it would almost have to be something catastrophic for him to call cut and reset. And basically, one of the things he told the actors is, like, look, like, if something happens, like, just keep going and we'll figure out. And one of the best ones is, in that big climactic scene, the lead guy, like bumps into somebody and falls down. Yeah, like, that was an accident. They just kept going. I'm curious, are there, like, your wonders in this are unbelievable, but are there any happy accidents that happened that
Yeah, actually, there'll be some. We'll be covering that more with some of the like supplementary stuff that Amazon's releasing. The take that's a 10-minute take or 9 minutes and 40 seconds or whatever, where Sierra's at the switchboard, Faye's at the switchboard. We actually had Jake Everett in the room reading his lines, just so that he could do his radio bit and she could respond to that. And there was a microphone above his head that was just attached to something, and it fell on him in his take. And Sierra didn't budge. Like, she was so in the mood. And that's the take we used. I think we had other takes on both sides, but her performance was the most dialed in there. So much so that when a mic fell off of a piece of equipment and landed on Jake's head, Jake, like, kind of kept saying his lines, but, you know, I think he cursed, and then Sierra doesn't do anything. She just keeps going and stays focused. And so that's the one I think of. There's a couple on the long one that we didn't really have any happy accidents there, because it was way too choreographed for that to have any, like, possible thing that we could implement. So that one is pretty much as we scripted it and as we choreographed it. But that the one you asked me, the happy accident with Sierra, like, you know, the mics falling on Jake, I don't know if it was a happy accident, but it proved that she could actually, like, stay in it no matter what.
That's a pro. That's awesome.
All right. I have to ask the origin of the running joke of the squirrel that had bitten through the wire.
The origin is my brother is a bartender in Oklahoma City, and they had a flickering neon sign out front of their bar, and they were going to get it fixed. So they went out there and they pulled the plastic off, and the flickering was caused by the fact that a squirrel had bitten through this wire, and it was dead, but the wire was sitting in its mouth. So they had to pull the thing out of the squirrel's mouth and then patch the wire. And I always just thought that was the funniest image. And I like that a town of people would all know this story and just kind of keep bringing it up, because that's how humans are. We all tend to know the same information and then kind of repeat it over and over again.
It made me laugh every time.
Good.
And then I'll close us off on this last one, because you use the conceit of going through the television set, and it gives it a bit of a serialized sci-fi TV vibe. And, you know, back when John Krasinski did The Quiet Place and he wasn't quite sure if he was going to go back and tell the story, but he had kind of consciously set up other campfires around. And I think at the time he did press for the first movie, he said, if someone else wanted to pick up the baton and tell another story set in this universe, I gave them a little bit of leeway. I'm curious if you could see someone else sort of using the conceit of going back into the television set, not necessarily picking up your story, but going back and maybe exploring a similar genre in a different way and almost just running with it in the way that you've laid the ground for them.
Oh, I mean, I think that was always kind of on the table. I've been asked about it by more than one production company or studio that has wanted to maybe turn it into an anthology type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gone that way yet, because I would think that we've already kind of set the bar high in terms of what I think is the quality of the movie and the quality of the storytelling. And if we came back to it, I would want it to maintain that kind of quality, sort of like the Toy Story franchise, right? Mm-hmm. Like you basically just know these guys, they're not going to do one until they've got something. And I don't really know that I have something yet, but if somebody A, came up with something that I thought was impressive, or B, if I thought something worked, I think that it is maybe an exciting possibility to crawl back into the TV and see another world.
Well, I love it.
Seriously, thank you so much. I feel like we would probably keep going, but seriously, this is an unbelievable interview, and seriously, thank you so much for your time, man. We really do appreciate it.
I appreciate your guys', you know, interest in the movie, and I hope that your fans and everybody kind of can get to where they understand my intention with the movie. And I think you guys can help with that.
Yeah, just in a time where, you know, it's franchises and sequels and recognizable things, we're thirsty for original content with, you know, inspiring ideas. And that's what we dialed into the most out of this film. So we're thrilled to get you on to talk about the making of it. And hopefully we'll have you back on.
For sure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much to Amazon Prime for giving us time with Andrew Patterson. If you guys haven't seen The Vast of Night, it's absolutely one of those films that you need to catch up with. I know that there's so many streaming options all of a sudden, and I know that we're missing going back to movie theaters, but there's some good stuff out now that you guys can watch on various streaming services, and some other good films on the way, which we will be teasing at the end of this episode. So let's get into news. We've been really looking forward to getting back to theaters, and with each week, we seem to get closer to what we thought was going to be a return to normal. But on Friday of last week, Warner Brothers just info dumped a bunch of release date changes. I will mention that Unhinged, the Russell Crowe film, is not Warner Brothers, but it did move itself back to July 10th. Still feels like it's going to be the first movie to open, to welcome people back to theaters. And again, today, when we're recording, Regal Cinemas said July 10th is the day that they're going to open. I think AMC Theaters said July 15th. Is that right? So somewhere around that middle of July that the big chains are looking to come back to. Kevin, Tenet. I keep saying, it sounds like I'm saying Tenant, and I don't mean to be saying Tenant, but someone yelled at me on social media. Tenant is now down for July 31st. We'll get into the other release date changes, but first and foremost, Kev, how are you doing?
I'm doing, you know, in regards to Tenant.
Sure, of course.
I mean, it's one of those interesting things where I'm just finding, I'm trying to hear both sides of this discussion.
Sure.
People who don't want to go back to the theaters and people who do want to go back to the theaters. I mean, to me, 2 weeks is nothing. I mean, I'm still happy it's coming out in July, July 31st, still going to be returning. You know, Inception opens up on July 17th for its 10th anniversary, which is really cool. So I will gladly go see Inception again in theaters, even though I have the Blu-ray at home. That's just how much I miss the theatrical experience. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you're caught in between a scenario where we do not understand where we are in the world. It's a very unprecedented, uncharted moment. I saw a quote today that basically said, like, you know, this could change within a week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're seeing cases spike in certain areas. It's so fascinating to me because I want Tenet to be that movie that does literally, quote unquote, save cinema, because I feel like we need to push people towards the movie theaters with something that big that would give them, because remember, like, if you're thinking about it like this, like if you're trying to get over that hump of going into a movie theater, King of Staten Island, Tenet. Let's look at both of those titles. Now, I'd love to see King of Staten Island in a theater, no question. But think about the one that's going to push you over the hump. What's the one that's going to say, oh, I kind of might go back for that one. And I feel like Tenet has the ability to be that film. July 31st, is it still going to happen? I think so. I mean, especially with that Regal news today, July 10th reopening. I think Nolan's more... Nolan seems more focused on saving movie theaters rather than the gigantic box office they would have maybe a year from now. And I get it from a business standpoint. If you're Warner Brothers and you want this movie to have the biggest audience possible, but I still believe you can have a 25 screen theater like AMC Empire, pop Tenet into every single screen, limit it to 25% capacity per theater, then you're good to go. And okay, because in my opinion,
let me push back slightly. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you're going to open restaurants, you can open movie theaters. And if you're not going to open movie theaters, don't open restaurants. It's the exact same thing.
Don't get about this, though, and I promise we'll move on right after this, Gabe, is that what's the difference between the 17th and the 31st in terms of where we're going to be as a society? And instead, all Nolan is doing and Warner Brothers is doing is cutting into the number of screens that they're going to have access to, because Mulan is held on to their 24th.
I think Mulan pushes.
I think Mulan goes to Disney Plus.
God, man.
I think Mulan missed its window, unfortunately. Yeah. And I
people
think
have forgotten about Mulan.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
And I, And I think what they're going to have to do to build momentum again for that film, because I don't believe Mulan is a movie that would push me over that, or push someone over that hump. I really don't. And I think that Mulan's going to, its best way now is Disney Plus. I don't think that's opening on the 24th.
Well,
so I think
Mulan has a big fan base. There's people who love that animated cartoon, but the live action without songs, I've heard from a number of people who are fans of that, they're like, I'm not interested in
but see,
that.
What's interesting is that's why I am interested. Like, I'm interested in seeing it from a historical angle. Like, that was always my biggest knock about these live action remakes is, like, if you're just going to make them shot for shot, I'll just watch the original. At least this one, they're looking at it like this was a historical event. So they're looking at it from the events of it. But here's what I'll say about Tenet. And then
you
I know
loved Lion King, though. You did love Lion
King. I'm
going
to punch you right in the throat. What I think about Tenet is them moving it back 2 weeks shows that it is shakable. It really seemed like they were doubling down and they were going to open on the 17th. Now that they have moved, they have shown kind of their hand a little bit and shown that they are willing to move it and they are susceptible. Even the great and powerful Christopher Nolan is susceptible to the precautions of COVID-19.
There was a story, though, that he was not happy. I don't know where that came out, but I saw the headline.
Look, I say this knowing that this is a podcast that bows at the power of Christopher Nolan. He's got to get over himself. He has to realize that this is
You're basing that on opinion.
Is the case, then he needs to get over himself, because this is something that is bigger than saving cinema. This is something that is bigger than one person's film. I mean, at the end of the day, I now am starting to wonder if, and we've sort of talked about this before, and I'm kind of surprised they didn't just go with this, if they don't push it to the Wonder Woman date in August and then push Wonder Woman back.
They did push Wonder Woman back. So let's
October
get to that.
October 2nd.
Yeah, I'm going to throw out real quick that in addition to Mulan potentially going to Disney Plus, and we don't know that for sure. We're just saying that as a speculation because the 24th would be. That's Kevin's guess right now. But we do know that Angelina Jolie had a movie that was coming from Disney. It's called The One and Only Ivan. It is an adaptation of a very, very popular family children's book that will be going to Disney Plus. It's not going to be making its way to theaters anymore. Yes.
Can I say one thing in rebuttal to Jake's discussion? And I find it interesting that people are questioning Christopher Nolan's character. And I've seen this a lot on Twitter recently, where people are going against Nolan because they think he cares about a movie more than people's lives. That's not what's happening here. Christopher Nolan cares about saving the theater experience. And that I don't think Christopher Nolan's lying in his bed at night going, oh yeah, people, you know, I don't care if people die. That's not what he's saying. I think what he's doing is he knows that we are in an economic situation where AMC theaters lost $2.4 billion in its first quarter, whatever the number was. And these theaters are hanging on by threads. So if you can put a film in there that people will go see, and that will help to secure and save our movie theaters, that's what Christopher Nolan's mindset is. I mean, I get that Warner Brothers is on the idea of we want to get the biggest box office opening. And I'm not criticizing either or. I just find it so annoying that people are criticizing Nolan's character online and saying that he doesn't care. That's not at all what's going on here. It is a purely business standpoint of saving movie theaters, where he has been trying to preserve that experience for years. I don't think it has anything to do with him not caring about people's health and lives. I just don't buy that. I'm sorry.
Cool. I think that's pretty clear. But there's a slot that is open, because as you guys just mentioned, why don't they push Tenet back to the Wonder Woman slot? These are the changes that start to hurt. So Wonder Woman 1984 now is October 2nd. Pushed back from August 14th, which was pushed back from June something, which was pushed back from November of the previous year. I mean, this is a movie that now I start to feel really bad for Patty Jenkins or Gal Gadot or people who just have had their movies relatively finished or ready to go. The John Krasinski's of the world, Black Widow, even, which I think is.
Oh my God, we have
finished.
Seen A Quiet Place 2. I keep forgetting that we've seen A Quiet Place Part 2.
Yeah, and can't talk about it. Yeah. No Time to Die, the new James Bond film, the final Daniel Craig James Bond film. That moved up
five
days.
That just seemed like a freaking lifetime ago. Remember when we were contemplating like whether or not we were going to that junket in London? Like, doesn't that seem like another world ago?
That was end of March, early April. We were trying to figure out whether that was still going to happen. The Matrix 4, which I don't think started any production. Is that right?
No, they did start. Yeah, they started production.
They did? Okay, mm-hmm. So they've moved from May of 2021 to April of 2022. Like, that's one of those, that's a fast nine jump of just like, hey, we'll see a year from when we thought we were going to come out. And the Tom Hanks Bios film, which is his science fiction dog movie and not his World War II submarine movie, is going to be moving to April of 2021 instead of us being able to see it in October.
Oh, that movie's going to destroy me.
Does Tom Hanks do press for Greyhound?
No.
Yes.
Oh, God, no. Yeah. No, no, no. No way. No way.
You think he'll do it, Jake?
Yeah.
Not a chance. Have you heard anything? Not a chance.
Oh, you've heard he's doing it. Oh, you already got him. Well, there you go.
He didn't get him. He would have told us a million times whether he got him. He might have heard that he's potentially going to get him for the show. For the show, Jakey, for the show, wink once if he's going to come on Rough Lens.
What show?
Good Day Chicago.
There we go.
All right. And for posterity, Gabe would like me to let everybody know that the New Mutants has not moved. Yet. It is still going to be coming out in August. I think it's August 27th. But I am 100% convinced. That is one of the funniest memes that I've ever seen in my entire life. There's the guy from Star Trek with the beard, whose name I don't know. But he also hosted one of those Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
And he's got like these little transitions in between scenes where he's just like, we made it up. It's totally false. Yeah.
That one, we not true.
Yeah, that one, not true. And they were like, Disney to all the New Mutants fans, we made it up. This one's not true. Turns out it was a lie. It's really, really funny. All right. In addition to all these movies getting pushed back, that has a ripple effect on the awards season. In case you don't know, we started this show as Awards Blend. You can find all of our retro merch in the retro section of the new shop that Gabe is launching. Awards Blend merch. And so the Oscars. The Oscars are totally screwed. They are going to be moving back 2 months and airing on April 25th of 2021. That also means that the eligibility for films to contend for the Oscars is going to be February of next year. Kev, what do you think about these changes? Because I don't really know how to process all this.
I mean, like, the move to April 25th doesn't surprise me because they have to have eligibility extend to the end of February because there are films that are in production.
Why?
What's going on, Jake?
Why do they have to have eligibility?
Makes perfect sense because there are films that weren't that had to shut down production that were still supposed to come out this year.
Tough shit.
Judge
the movies that came out this year.
Wait, what are you, dude? Are you not? You're missing my point completely.
Like, no, I understand there will be lesser films to judge between January 1st and December 31st. But play the card you're dealt. Dance with the one that brought you. Judge the films that came out this year.
Why just have them compete next year?
Yes, at the end of the year, if Elizabeth Moss really gave one of the best performances that came out this year, then fucking nominate her. Like I don't understand. No. Why do we have to like make sure other like Oscar movies make sure they wrap up so they can get in so we can give it to the same type of movie we always give it to? Just play the cards that you were dealt, and if these are the movies that came out this year, then judge those.
Then Jake, tell me why you were okay with the eligibility change for VOD films to be nominated for Oscars. That was a change.
They're at least coming out this year.
Yeah, and they're done.
But that's a new change that you were okay with. So this one you're not okay with because, see, in my opinion, we are in an uncharted, unprecedented moment in history where production had to shut down for films that were supposed to come out later this year. And if those films had to shut down, why is it their fault that they can't compete in the Oscars? I find that to be ridiculous.
It just feels like notion. They want to make sure that they get in as many of the like Oscar type of films as possible so that they don't have to give it to anything out of the ordinary that they normally wouldn't give it to.
I'm going to say this. I guarantee that the Oscars, before they announced this change, took a survey of all the films that they quote unquote feel will be in contention to get a sense of whether they are ready or not. Right. And if they heard back from enough people who said, like, let's use Mr. Spielberg as an example. If he was like, hey, I'm not going to have West Side Story ready in time because I still have to do a bunch of pickups and it'll be January or February, or, you know, two or three other examples of movies like that. I bet you that that's what pushed them to say, OK, fine, we'll push the eligibility to February. and give those films time to compete. I don't know where I fall on this. This is really interesting to see you two divided by this, because I didn't give it as much thought, but I'm a little bit more with Jake in that, fine, if you maintain the end of December as your availability window and it means you cut down on the number of films that are going to be ready in time, cool. You know, that's the reaction to us being in a weird time. And then those movies that come out in January and February, they would just compete next year. Yeah. They would just be Kevin, in the next
race. I don't buy it.
Kevin, I have a question. Let's say Tenet comes out and and it is like a masterpiece. And we're like, oh my God, this is Nolan's year. He's got the Oscar in his hand. It's about time. Give this man an Oscar. And then because they pushed back the eligibility window, something slips in on like February 26th. And it's like that Oscar-y type of movie. And they were able to get in, and all of a sudden, like, you know, a King's Speech.
The new Tom Hooper.
The new Tom Hooper film comes in. And
Tom Hooper does a movie about social justice. Yeah.
You're
race.
Not going to tell me that like that's going to bother you a little bit?
No, it wouldn't bother me at all. Because if Tenet wins by default because not enough films came out, I don't want Tenet to win an Oscar.
Guys a couple of weeks ago, would it bother you if Nolan won this year despite the fact that there was less? And you're like, no, it wouldn't bother me at all.
Would have an asterisk.
I'm saying it wouldn't bother me personally if Nolan won. I'm saying Tenet winning Best Picture because enough films didn't get made to come out, I think is the wrong way to celebrate that movie. I think it actually takes Tenet down a few pegs.
I specifically asked you guys if that were to happen, and you guys were like, I wouldn't care.
You said Christopher Nolan. You didn't say Tenet winning Best Picture. You said Christopher Nolan.
He will win an Oscar if Tenet wins Best Picture.
No. The question you asked was, would you be happy if Christopher Nolan won an Oscar this year in a year with less films? I said, of course I want Christopher Nolan win an Oscar. But Tenet winning Best Picture with less films this year, to me, makes the film a lesser important film, in my opinion.
I have a question to kind of... that's a good question for the show as far as like our personal opinion about a specific movie, but... I'm leaning towards Jake's perspective here because in a sense, you know, we're not just seeing movies this year change. Early, just a few minutes ago, we're discussing movies next year that are being pushed back a year, and we're kind of seeing how it's not like we're just seeing 1 year affected. We're just kind of the whole slate is being shifted year over year until we get to a more normal sort of state. So does this just kind of push that down the road? If we open up this eligibility till February, are they going to shift that eligibility every year, right, or is next year there's only going to be 10 months?
Some and within year that 10 gonna months, have to be truncated.
Yeah.
No. It's going to move forward like that. It's going to be.
It's always going to be.
You think it's going to be forever?
Oh yeah, I think it's going to be a new pattern.
What? Yeah. I wouldn't be into that. Why?
But
it's not the best film of the year. It's the best film of parts of these 2 years. It's like a baseball season. Yeah. It's or like a basketball season.
Like a movie comes out on February 6th and wins Best Picture in April, like 2 weeks, like isn't that strange?
What's the difference between a movie coming out in December and winning an Oscar in February? Come on,
Two different years.
No, yeah. That's ridiculous,
man. The Gregorian calendar.
I mean, it's the year that it came out.
I think you guys are not thinking about all these productions of so many people who are working on these movies that wanted to get their film made and were shut down from the pandemic, and then they can't make their movie. So all the Oscars are doing is saying, listen, man, we understand
that is the argument then that they are making movies to win Oscars.
That you want to still make your film this year. I find it. So let me ask you this.
It shouldn't be about winning Oscars.
If a production shut down and the movie wasn't finished until February of next year, you're telling me that because that movie was made in February, it has to be on the next Oscar cycle?
It's about when it comes out. It's about when it comes out.
I think it's such backwards thinking. Like, if you have a movie come out December 31st and you let it win an Oscar on February.
Studios hold movies all the time for weird Oscar calendars.
I'm saying I just don't buy the argument that films should suffer because of the pandemic. I feel like that.
Why are they suffering? Then your argument is that a movie is made to win Oscars.
That is
your argument of like what suffering is.
No, it's not. I said movie productions. I think it's disrespectful to a movie production and a director if you're going to tell that person that they can no longer participate. Listen, if you want to put a movie up for an Oscar next year. I just don't believe in what you're saying personally.
I don't understand what the problem with waiting is. Like, yeah, okay, like, sorry, I'm sorry you weren't able to complete your film. Sorry. It'll come out next year, so you will compete in next year's. Like that's
look at how well Get Out did, and it came out in February. Look at how well Black Panther did. It came out in February.
You're talking about a chunk of time missing of films that weren't shot or produced or finished within 3 or 4 or 5 month period. You cannot have an Oscar. You cannot. It's also not the world's fault that we were going through a pandemic.
But like, we could get so many more interesting winners from this year.
It's a limited landscape. You don't have enough movies to even have competition.
You call it limited. I say there's potential for people to win that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have won.
Is there not merit to the fact that a limited landscape is a correct reflection of the year that that Oscar represents?
I think that's fair.
Like,
too.
It's if we're talking about looking at it. From a historical standpoint, 20 years from now, do we want the movie that came out in 2021 to win an Oscar? Or do we want the movie that came out in the weird year?
So you're saying a movie
to reflect what that year was.
That started to film in January, that was shut down by the pandemic.
You're putting so much stock in when it starts filming. What does it matter when it starts filming?
I believe in the eligibility extension because I feel like it's a fair trade to films that weren't able to finish. That's just how I feel about it.
I don't think that's really a factor because look at...
Well, it's an opinion. I'm allowed to have my opinion.
No. Yeah, I just don't think that that's like a logistic factor as far as like the actual effect of the film. Like Andrew Patterson, for instance, shot his film like 3 years ago, he said, but it just came out this year. You know, that happens. Like people shoot stuff all the time. I think whenever your film is complete is when it's complete. And so compete in that year. I don't know. That's where I lean. But
hold on. Ultimately, I think the people who are on the side of Jake and Gabe believe that the Oscars should honor, come hell or high water, whatever came out. From January 1st to December 31st, that should be what the Oscars honor. Now, it could be in a theater, it could be on VOD, and we all acknowledge that there is a pandemic that has disrupted everything. But they feel that it's more important to keep the parameters of January 1st to December 31st. And if you acknowledge that this year is going to be weird because we don't have a lot of movies that are eligible, the ones that can't hit that December 31st time frame just have to go back to the next year of January 1st to December 31st. And before you jump in, I think a lot of those films would essentially, and we'll use Spielberg again as an example because he's a late December release. If he says, all right, we can't make this window. And this has happened to a number of films over the years where they pick their release date slots.
But not because of a pandemic. It's a different story, man.
He'd go back to November of the next year. And he'd be back in the Oscar contention. It would just be another year. When we're talking about other films like these other movies, Matrix 4, Tom Hanks' Bios, they're jumping a whole year. But they're not Oscar contenders. I said, well, maybe they will be. Who knows? We have no idea. We haven't seen them yet. It's just whether you think the integrity of the calendar should be January 1st to December 31st. That's all.
There's a three-month hole in the filmmaking calendar. They're filling a three-month hole with the eligibility. It makes perfect sense. Perfect sense.
The last thing I'll say is 10 years from now, I'm loathing having the conversation of who won best original screenplay in 2020 for the year 2020. Well, this one, but it came out in February 2021. But that was like, I don't want to have that conversation 10 years from now when I forget that they made this change. It just sounds so.
This is without a doubt one of the most heated conversations that we've ever had on Real Blend. And I didn't think the Oscars pushing back a few weeks was going to trigger this. But more importantly, I want to hear from everybody else about how you feel, whether you think the eligibility window should have been pushed, whether you think that the Oscars should honor. Where do you think the Oscars should honor? And I am dying to hear people's feedback to this. I'm going to talk for a little bit because you guys need to settle down, take a deep breath, tell each other you love in a text chain, please. Yeah, oh, there's a big hug from Jake. There you go. DC has set a virtual fan event called the DC Fan Dome. They announced it today, the day that we are recording. It is going to be held on August 22nd. This is really exciting for one really big reason that I will get to in a second. But essentially what they're going to be doing is instead of being able to go to the San Diego Comic-Con, which is not happening this year, they're going to tease most of their stuff across all of the mediums, film, television, comic books, video games, toys. It's all coming to this virtual event. And I find this really interesting because I think it's setting a precedent for what we might see from a lot of these events moving forwards if the studio can figure out ways to get on board. A virtual way for all people to participate in what is, I believe, going to be a free event. It's 24 hours, so it's a limited time period. It starts on a Saturday at 1 o'clock Eastern. You go in, you explore all the different areas of this fandom. You could see the movies that they've been talking about, and we'll keep it to the films, but there's a lot of television stuff also, especially for DC and Warner Brothers. The Batman is going to have an area. Wonder Woman 1984 is going to have an area. Black Adam, The Rock's upcoming superhero film, is expected to have an area. They called a Flash area, but I don't know if that's Ezra Miller or if it's going to be the CW show. And then, which really caught my eye, Zack Snyder's Justice League, which they referred to in the press release as the Snyder Cut of Justice League, is going to have an area. And I find that to be fairly groundbreaking, because that was the redheaded stepchild that Warner Brothers didn't want to acknowledge that it had. And now it's part of an official press release. And I'm going to go on record. Oh, I'm wearing my shirt. I didn't even realize that I'm wearing my shirt. This shirt, by the way, is really funny, because there's a Harley Quinn animated program on DC.
I've heard it's great.
It's I've only seen one or two episodes. It's really raunchy. The humor is very dark. And they put a joke into one of their episodes where there were these two guys who lived in their basement, and they argued about pop culture. And one of them had a T-shirt that said, "The Last Jedi is not canon." And the other guy had released the Snyder Cut T-shirt. And it was supposed to be a dig at the fan base. And instead, the Snyder Cut fans were like, "That shirt's awesome. We want to own it," basically. So they went to this website, Ink to the People, and they turned it into a fundraising charity for the... Yeah, and this is it. So
that's awesome.
And I was like, well, it has the title of my book on it, so I'm gonna buy one and wear it and also support a really good charity. So, I'm psyched for this. This is August 22nd. It is going to be a ton of DC and Warner Brothers content. I'm expecting trailers for things like, I think Matt Reeves probably will have trailers cut together for the Batman. Maybe The Rock will put together some type of panel for Black Adam. Patty Jenkins, again, we talked about the fact that Wonder Woman 1984 got pushed back to October, but she might have some more footage, maybe a scene to show for it. And again, it's open to everybody. It's going to be global and online, and you can just sort of punch in and do it at your own pace, Jakey.
Do you think they're going to be showing a Snyder Cut trailer?
Yeah, I think if that's probably the place where he's going to have it ready to go. Wow. People have been wondering where and when and how he might put a trailer together. There's no Comic-Con, and since Warner Brothers is officially sponsoring this, then yeah, I think he's probably gonna show some footage then. So I'm excited. Put it on the calendar. DC's DC fandom down for August 22nd. Let's shift to let's get into another fight and talk about this week in movies. Coming to Amazon Prime on the 19th is Joseph Gordon-Levitt's new thriller, 7500. Right?
That's how it's... Amazon told me 7500. But in the movie, and then during my interview today, Joseph Gordon-Levitt says 7500, because that's actually the call that you make if there is a terrorist hijacking. So to me, if he says 7500 in the movie, then that's what the title of the movie needs to be. He never says 7500.
Right. And it wouldn't be 7500 if the code is 7500.
Yeah,
Jakey, explain what the movie is about and then how you feel about it.
It's a very tight, tense, claustrophobic sort of thriller that takes place, I would say, entirely in the cockpit of a film. Basically, it is a flight that leaves Berlin. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the co-pilot, and a terrorist begin what is the hijacking of the plane. Through certain circumstances, Joseph Gordon-Levitt finds himself locked into the cockpit. Hearing a banging on the outside as the terrorists try to break in. Of course, ground control is telling him under no circumstances are you to open that door and let them in. We're gonna divert you. You've got 30 minutes until you can find the next airport we can bring you to. The X factor that makes things complicated is that not only can Joseph Gordon-Levitt see what's going on through a monitor in the cockpit, so he can see what's going on immediately outside the door, one of the flight attendants is the mother of his child. So it's not like he can just stand by and sort of say, well, whatever happens, I'm going to land this plane. The mother of his child is on the other side of that door. So he's torn internally with this conflict of, I want to open the door and do something, but they could get into the cockpit and, crash the plane and kill everybody.
Mm-hmm. And you liked it.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was really a tight, tense, like I said, very tight, tense, claustrophobic thriller. I found myself asking, I love a good movie that makes me ask those giant moral questions of what would I do? And this is such a horrible phrase, but what is the acceptable loss? Because you have to imagine, if a terrorist does get control of the plane, not only is everyone on the plane going to die, but then wherever the plane crashes, that's surrounding people, you know. So, but then, you know, you've got people on the other side of this door who you genuinely care about. You really start having this really intense moral conflict of like, what would I do? And I genuinely don't know what I would have done. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt gives an incredible performance. I've always thought he was a fantastic actor. I didn't really, you know, I think that the terrorist as presented in the film, one in particular, not necessarily like just a very like generic black or white villain. You know, they're not like the bad guy, you know, a generic bad guy in a Die Hard sequel. Mm-hmm. You really kind of start to question, who are these people and how did they get to this point? And I think there's some really interesting conversations to show that like a lot of that times it lies somewhere in a gray area. Very rarely is, you know, are aspects of the world black and white. Mm-hmm. And I thought it did all of that in 90 minutes, which I thought was really impressive. I found myself audibly screaming at the TV out loud. So no, I really dug it. Very much enjoyed it.
And Kev, you learned a lot about the technical side of it.
Yeah, it was cool. It's a really interesting story. It's like very intense, very immersive. And I found that to be a very interesting tool that the filmmaker used. And I thought Gordon Levitt's performance was great. I recommend it. I mean, I recommend it with a, I guess, an asterisk.
Yeah, give that caveat.
Yeah, it's an amazing film that I wouldn't recommend people to watch, I guess.
Because it's super intense. Like, and this is what I didn't like about it. And both of the guys went first and got to see it. And so I went into it kind of really expecting to dig it. And instead, I didn't like it at all. And it made me super uncomfortable. And I think for the point of view that Jake is trying to say, like, the premise almost comes across like a Die Hard-esque, you know, setup. It could be played that way, a Steven Seagal type thing or an Air Force One or something. And it takes that premise but strips every heroic Hollywood aspect of it and just plays it as life would probably play out. And so from that point of view, it's really, really uncomfortable. And I just found it to be like mean and nasty, and I didn't see the redeeming qualities of it. Like a lot of times I'll just sort of ask myself, like, why am I watching this movie? You know, like, what is this movie trying to put through? And if it just wants to put you into a really uncomfortable situation and make you endure it is the right way to put it, I guess, then fine, that's mission accomplished. But I don't necessarily enjoy movies like that. And so, and one aspect of it, which Kevin pointed out that I probably wouldn't have picked up if he didn't mention it, is that there's no score. And I guess sometimes score would sort of alleviate some of the tension, but instead he keeps the constant hum of the airplane noise. And there's a pounding on the door because it all takes place inside the cockpit, and the pounding on the door, sometimes it's from the terrorists, sometimes it's from the people, the passengers on the plane. And it is a consistent noise that just drove me nuts. And again, it's gotta be organic to the situation. You know, that's what would happen in that scenario, but it just drove me nuts. And so while I think both of you guys more appreciated the technical craft of it and the tight 90 minute, you know, immersion of it, it just left me feeling so uncomfortable. And so, I don't know. I don't know if I can necessarily recommend it, but check out their interviews.
What did you think of Gordon Levitt's performance?
I thought it was good. I thought the screenplay, unfortunately, put him in some situations that just felt like they were a little bit predictable. Like I kind of knew, like, and I don't want to really say too much because it's a little bit too, I thought he did okay with what he was handed, but the premise of it didn't really hook me. So the same thing goes for our next VOD June 19th thing, which is You Should Have Left. And I'm not going to get too deep into it because both of you guys plan on watching it after the show.
Yep.
But David Koepp came on the show this week, talked about the production of it. It's a haunted house film, sort of. Kevin Bacon stars in it, Amanda Seyfried. And when David was talking about the opening shot of the film, he says that it lays out everything that's going on in the movie, which is a photograph of a family, and then a shadow sort of falls over it. So it's a bit of a haunted house movie. It's a bit of a family drama movie. All I'll say is that it just didn't necessarily congeal for me, didn't come together. But I'll leave it for you guys to sort of determine, and I'll leave all the spoilers out of it. So text me afterwards. Let me know what you guys thought of it. I know that's not helping our audience at all. Where I bring up a movie that's going to VOD, and then I tell you guys that those two will text me after they watch it. But you'll hear their reviews on their respective platforms at the end of the week. So, Blend Game. We're talking about The King of Staten Island that came to video on demand, and Pete Davidson and Judd Apatow. So we were playing #JuddApatowBlend, where we are going to reveal our favorite films by Judd Apatow. And I want Jake to go first because he asked us an interesting question before he made his choice and then didn't tell us what he was picking. So, Jakey, make your pick and defend it.
Yes. Okay, fair. So, I asked when this started, could I pick a movie that Judd Apatow wrote but maybe didn't necessarily direct, because he has written a lot of stuff. And the reason I wanted to ask that question is because, like, I like a lot of Judd Apatow's movies, but they're all just so long. They're all 20 to 30 minutes longer than I think they need to be, which means for me, there's little to no replay value in a lot of his movies. Like, as much as I love, like, 40-Year-Old Virgin and even, like, King of Staten Island, just the thought of, like, putting that 220 movie, like, on casually, I'm just like, I'll turn on something else. But he did write a movie in the 90s that was a pinnacle of my childhood. I loved it. I thought it was hilarious. I still think it's hilarious. And so make fun of me all you want. I'm going with a film called Heavyweights. And if you've never seen Heavyweights, it's about
He
wrote Heavyweights.
I didn't know that.
It has what I think is one of the all-time great Ben Stiller performances. A performance that I would say he borrowed from in later years to make some of his more, like, I would argue, like, his character from Dodgeball is basically his character from Heavyweights. Just a little bit, like, turned up to the nth degree. Jerry Stiller's in it and gives a great performance. Paul Feig is in it and gives a really funny performance. But it's basically, a group of kids go to what is meant to be like this health camp, but secretly they know it's a fun summer camp where they can just go and have a good time. The summer that they are there happens to be the summer that the original owners lose the camp, and this new health nut comes in and basically makes camp a living hell for them. And it's about how they spend that summer sort of becoming friends, but also overcoming. I'm making it sound a lot more serious than it is, but it's a really fun, lighthearted Disney movie that was very much a part of my childhood growing up. I had it recorded on VHS, I think, like, off of the Disney Channel, and then would just, like, rewatch it. I loved it. I still think it's funny. And if you were to ask me, if you were to put everything that Judd Apatow has done in front of me and say, like, you could watch one right now, I would watch Heavyweights long before I would watch one of the movies he directed.
Interesting. All right, that's fine. I get Heavyweights confused with Disorderlies, had a rap group called the Fat Boys. The Fat Boys? Who did Disorderlies? What? Am I that old? Come on, guys. I'm going to look that up while Kevin gives his pick. Kev, you're up.
Paul Feig was really good in Heavyweights.
Yeah,
and also,
he is.
I always wondered why the screenwriters for Heavyweights didn't sue the screenwriters for Dodgeball, because the character Stiller plays in Dodgeball is the same character.
Same guy, right? Tony Perkis.
I always found that to be weird. Mine's Knocked Up, I think, because I rewatched his films recently. That film, to me, combines, like, the best combination of the leads and the side characters. Like, the side characters in Knocked Up, to me, are so great, and I love being home with them. And to me, that's just his best film from a story standpoint, character standpoint. I just find his humor in that film to be great. And that's my pick, Judd Apatow.
People forget how good Rogan is in that movie. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's so known as Seth Rogen now at this point, but he burst on scene and held down a leading role in that part.
Do you remember that poster?
Is it them in
the poster? The poster was just his head. There might have been one later, but there's one. It was just his head. Like, yeah. And this is, like, really before Seth Rogen blew up, so no one really knew who he was. He'd been in a few things. I think the biggest thing he'd been in by that point was 40-Year-Old Virgin. But it's just his, like, head, kind of with, like, that goofy smile. And then, and then it just had the tagline, "What if this guy got you pregnant?" Which I thought was such a great poster.
That's a really good Seth Rogen laugh, too, by the way. I'm going to give you a lot of credit for that.
Thank you.
I'm a little bit with Kevin in that I feel like 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up are the two closest Judd Apatow films. I feel like those are the movies that he set out to make. He found the right people to fit the characters he wanted to write. And then from that point on, he kind of drifted into other types of storytelling, which I've talked about on the show most recently. Funny People, he might have had a big idea about Funny People. He liked doing stand-up. He liked being with stand-up comedians, but that feels like it was fashioned around Sandler. And then you got into This Is 40, which is the Knocked Up spinoff kind of thing that he went after, and then Trainwreck, which I thought was fashioned around Amy Schumer. And I think Pete Davidson, if you don't have Pete Davidson, You don't have King of Staten Island. I don't think he makes that movie. So I'm going with 40-Year-Old Virgin because I think he had a great premise for that. And then he found Steve Carell. You know, I don't think Steve Carell kind of came around like, I have this idea. I think Steve Carell was just the perfect choice for that. And again, we don't give Steve Carell enough credit. And Brendan is rewatching The Office right now, and I'm watching episodes that I just haven't seen in years upon years. And I'm reminded of what a gifted comedian he is.
Never win an Emmy for that? He never won an Emmy.
It's insane. And you can go back through one of our old episodes too and find Kevin's dissertation on Brick and just how brilliant of a character Brick is. And Carell doesn't get the credit that he deserves. And then, of course, just for holding down the 40-Year-Old Virgin. I think that combination of Apatow and him make that my all-time favorite film. It's probably it's like a Michael Bay syndrome too. His earliest films were his shortest ones, and then they got a little bit more lost in who they are as filmmakers. And I think Judd Apatow and Michael Bay both need just an editor, just as who sits in the room with them and says, maybe this scene can go, or maybe chop this one out. But and again, I in a way, almost like with Spike, I don't like to say that, oh, your earliest stuff is your best stuff and you can't ever overcome that. I think especially with King of Staten Island, it shows that Judd has some really good storytelling left in him, and maybe he's going to keep looking for that project that just connects. But 40-Year-Old Virgin to me is really, really funny. Going to next week's blend game. Audience picks. I'm sorry. Aiden Erdahl said, my favorite Judd Apatow movie is King of Staten Island. It's his best film in that it balances comedy and drama, and it has some amazing jokes and great moments. John Palmer says Superbad, and Gabe is asking if that's as a producer. Did he produce Superbad?
He probably did. Yeah. I don't think he wrote
it.
He produced Superbad.
He didn't write or direct it.
Producer seems like a stretch.
It has his.
That's a reach.
It has his voice in it. It has his style in it, I guess.
Sure. All right, John. John, I mean, write us a longer message and defend that. Okay, but then
could I say that, like, Back to the Future is my favorite Spielberg movie?
No, I wouldn't argue that, necessarily. The blend game is an open translation, necessarily. John,
I feel like I'm being very combative on the show this week.
You really are. Yes. You're you're being very aggressive. I don't care.
Not aggressive. I'm being I consider it the voice of logic.
There's so much participation from everybody this week. I want to thank everyone who played along on Judd Apatow Blend. For next week, we're going with an idea that has come out of our text chain, and it is called hashtag warm blanket blend. And Gabe, I want you to explain warm blanket. I'm glad that Gabe is weighing in on the show a little more often. So please explain warm blanket blend for us.
So warm blanket blend is just kind of that movie that when you watch it, it sort of gives you that warm and fuzzy feeling. It makes you feel comfortable or secure or whatever. And it doesn't necessarily mean that like the movie's content does that, but it can just be like the nostalgic feeling of watching it, or just the way that it's stylistically done or whatever, just puts you in like a nice comforting place. This came up with me rewatching Knives Out this past weekend. And I realized just how much I love that movie and didn't really expect it to be as high on the list of my favorite, you know, movies from last year as I think it is now. But because it's such a fun movie, because it's such a fun mystery, it reminds me of like watching movies when I was a kid and just following the mystery of something and kind of being entertained. So for me, that's like a warm blanket movie. Suicide and murder and whatever is not necessarily warm blanket, but that's why I say, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be the content.
Wow. I'm excited for this one.
I'm going to go out of my way to not pick Human Centipede 3, although it's definitely my obvious choice for warm blanket blend. Thank you very much.
Stop losing bets, dude.
Recommended. Okay, so the subject line for this review this week comes from someone named Newbie100876. And they said, recommended for all basement-dwelling movie fans. Now, I'm going to take offense to that right off the bat.
I'm from Texas. We don't have basements.
There you go. Neither do we in North Carolina, ironically. The soil is more like a clay.
Yeah, we're below sea level.
Yeah, I think it's a southern thing. And they write, I have been listening to this podcast since the awards blend days, and I look forward to it every week. Sean, your knowledge, description, and overall critique of why you love a film is simply poetic. All right, I'm back in. I'm back in with you, newbie 100876. It's simply poetic. I often replay your descriptions because you catch things I never have. Kevin, your passion and enthusiasm for film is infectious, and you've convinced me to like things I once hated. Jake
is also there.
Your sense of humor is the best, and you have a wonderful laugh. I'm usually in agreement with you, but I definitely love the banter you bring. Not this week, sir, not this week. And Gabe, you have the voice of an angel. Glad we get to occasionally hear you when you come out of your lair. That is one of the best reviews that this podcast has ever received. Thank you very much, sir, for sending it. We have seen a ton of great support from everybody, both on the Facebook page and the emails that you guys send. Who sent us this about The Double? We mentioned a movie called The Double last week in the Blend game. And then the listener, who Gabe is going to look it up. While we're doing that, I'm going to wrap us up with where you can find us on social media, at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean _ O'Connell. You can drop us a review on iTunes, email it to us, or post it to that Facebook community page. Gabe, just say it. You can just say it. You don't have to text it to me.
Oh, I didn't want to interrupt you. Laura Eddy was kind enough to send a great email about The Double.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we'll be back next week with... we're going to look forward to the new Steve Carell movie that's coming out with Jon Stewart called Irreversible. I can't wait to review that one next week. So until then.
Dunkirk.
Thank you.
I think it's, is it Irresistible? I don't
know. Oh, it is Irresistible. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. We're a movie podcast.
The new Steve Carell film. Oh, it's not Irreversible. That's a really bad movie that people wouldn't want to discuss or see Steve Carell in.